Welcome to episode 235 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today we have a US focus, and we'll be finding out about Big Sky Resort in Montana and asking an expert about multi-pass options such as the Epic and Icon Pass. We also have our regular snow reports, your feedback, plus more Team GB news. And equipment fans will be pleased to know that Al is back on the podcast reporting from La Clusa, where he is testing next year's kit. Now, my name is Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. Firstly, I am delighted to introduce Nancy Scheel from Big Sky Resort in Montana, USA. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Ian.
And you're in Big Sky at the moment. Can you see out the window? Have you got any snow falling at this moment?
It is currently not snowing. We have a bit of a break in our storms with another one expecting to come in later this weekend. And it's dark still.
Thank you very much. I know it's 7 a.m. for you over in Montana. My second guest today is joining us from the East Coast of the States. He is the expert on the US snow sports industry. You might have come across his podcast, the Storm Skiing Podcast, currently up to 197 interviews with owners and managers of ski resorts across the state. So I'm very pleased to welcome Stuart Winchester. Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing real well, Ian. Great to make this cross-Atlantic connection. I'm really excited about this.
Excellent. Are you on the East Coast? Whereabouts are you?
I, along with my cat, are in Brooklyn, New York, which sounds like a weird place to be a ski bum, but there's actually 200 ski areas within a six-hour drive from New York City, and there's direct flights almost everywhere.
Okay. Well, I have connected New York to a ski trip in the past before, and I hope to perhaps in the future again. But let's start off. A question I like to ask all of my guests when they join me on the show is, when did you last ski or snowboard? So let's start with you, Nancy. I'm guessing it was yesterday.
I actually took a break from putting my feet into the ski boots yesterday, but I have been skiing nearly every day since the season started.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. We're going to come on to that when we have our chat about Big Sky later. What are conditions like in Big Sky at the moment?
Well, this week it's been sunny and a bit warm, and so the conditions are right now firm, a little chalky in the shady spots, and a little spring-like on the sunny parts.
Okay, that's a very accurate description. What about yourself, Stuart? You've got a lot of ski resorts within reach of you. When were you last on snow?
So I had a big weekend. My son, every Sunday, is in a seasonal program at a little mountain here called Mount Peter. 250 vertical feet, 3 chairlifts, full of kids, but they do what they do really well. So we go up there every Sunday. On Saturday, I got up really early. I drove up to New Hampshire and Vermont, and I did something I called Surface Lift Saturday, where I visited a bunch of 5 different surface lift ski areas that I'd never been to before that ran entirely on rope toes or Poma lifts or T-bars. And that was a lot of fun because these places are very obscure, but they're very community focused. There's never anyone hardly there. And there's just an atmosphere of kind of joy of skiing that sometimes it's harder to get at the larger areas that are very overwhelmed at times by these mega passes, as we'll talk about.
That is really interesting. I can't recall what podcast it was in before. We need to clarify, you know, to European listeners, surface lifts means what you said there, you know, what we might call button lifts or drag lifts and rope toes. So, you're traveling on the surface the whole time. Are those what you'd call like mom and pop ski resorts?
These actually, for the most part in America, the surface lift only ski areas that have remained tend to be actually community owned, usually run by the local town or municipality. Most of what we call mom and pops have managed to survive with pretty aggressive installation of snowmaking. And they tend to have lifts that are on the older side. But these are, a lot of these folks are very handy and wrenchy and hardwired for this sort of thing. So yeah, the surface lifts are usually these kind of municipal little areas. And often they're either free or the lift ticket is less than $20, sometimes as low as $5.
And what was the snow like up in New Hampshire, wherever you skied over the weekend?
It was quite good, depending on where you were. I got some sunshine turns. That was nice. A little place called Kank. That's right across from this huge resort, Loon Mountain, but no one knows about it. Then I went up to a place called Northeast Slopes in Vermont, and it was the kind of place where there was about 4 inches of snow, natural snow, and there was weeds sticking up through everything, but they opened the whole mountain. So I was able to ski everywhere, and it was just some really interesting lines. I would call it marginal snow, but a very good experience.
Excellent. We do have a few snow reports from some of our regular contributors. So let's have a listen to them. We've got Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy, who's reporting in from the Dolomites. Alex Armand from Tip Top Ski Coaching is down in Ladies Out. And Alex Irwin from 150 Days of Winter is reporting from Courchevel.
Ian, good morning. Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy reporting in to you from the Marmolada Glacier, at the top of the Marmolada Glacier here in the Italian Dolomites. I tell you what, it's a spectacular morning, hardly a cloud in the sky, and really looking forward to the rest of the day. Well, we've got a heck of a weather story to tell you, because from Sunday morning earlier on, it started snowing and it pretty much did not stop until about 8 p.m. last night. And actually, there is a two-sided story to that, because from about 1,400 metres and below, it was raining. Cortina was absolutely sopping wet, the town itself. And I was in Corvara, San Cassiano, and it really was raining hard. So the lower slopes are a bit packed and a bit icy, but above 1,400 metres, absolutely spectacular. I'm looking across at the Sella Massif at this moment in time, and it is just draped in a white blanket. So I think that the next couple of weeks or so are going to be totally spectacular. If you're coming to the Dolomites, you'll have a wonderful, wonderful time. And if you see me out and about on the slopes, do say hi. Ciao, Ian.
Hi, this is Alex from Tip Top Ski Coaching here in Ladies Out with an update on snow conditions. Well, what a week we've had. Snow. Yesterday was blue skies, sunshine and fresh powder, and more snow again today. So the pieces have been well topped up, are soft, well-groomed and hero snow, and the off-piste is soft and beautiful.
Hi, Ian. Alex from 150 Days of Winter with probably the quickest, most last minute, hastily put together snow report for the Three Valleys. This week it snowed, and it snowed substantially. That about sums it up. What? You want more? Well, there was more light fresh powder on the mountain than at a Russian student social evening at a private chalet. It snowed enough that I skied thigh-deep, fresh tracks on both days. In Val Thorens, it snowed enough that the Freeride World Tour was delayed until Wednesday. For everyone in resort, they were rewarded by truly epic conditions and, as it's still low season, relatively quiet peace. Instead of coming over half-term, find a disease with a week's quarantine, pull a sickie and come and enjoy the great conditions. And on that irresponsible bombshell, if you are stuck in the office and want to see my recent videos of powder skiing and French Mogul Cup, come and subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'm just off to watch Michaela Schifrin compete under the floodlights in the slalom for hopefully our 100th FIS victory. Ciao.
And don't forget, if you want to help the Ski Podcast and save yourself some money this winter, all you need to do is use the code SKIPODCAST when you book your ski hire at InSportRent.com. That applies to ski hire booked in their massive network across France, Austria and Switzerland. That is hundreds of resorts. You'll get a guaranteed additional discount, or simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Now, we've got a little bit of race news. Mia Brooks, she's having a stellar season again. She came third in the X Games Slopestyle in Aspen. She was fourth in the previous night's Big Air. Zoe Atkin came fourth in the ski halfpipe. Jasmine Taylor in Telemark, she picked up some more wins. She's got three wins, a second and a third so far this season. She's ranking first overall. She looks like she'll be on track to retain her crystal globe. Laurie Taylor tied with Dave Riding for 15th at Kitzbühel in the slalom. I don't know if he's ever beaten him, so he'll be gutted that he didn't get that extra hundredth of a second on him. And I just want to pass on some congratulations to Freddie and Zach Carrick-Smith. Regular listeners to the podcast will know that we sponsor the three Carrick-Smith brothers. They are flying out to Georgia with their coach and mum, Emma, and the rest of the GB team on the 7th of February, heading to the European Youth Olympics. So we wish them luck and we will report. Now, if you listen to our equipment episodes earlier this year, you'll know Al is the expert on kit. He's currently out in La Clusa testing next year's kit at the SIGB ski test. So let's have a listen to how he and Amy Marwick, who's with him, are getting on.
Hi, Ian. I'm here with Amy Marwick from the SIGB at the 2025 ski test, where we're actually skiing on next year's winter 25-26 skis. So what is this ski test, Amy?
So the ski test is an opportunity for all of the UK ski industries, retailers and media to come and test next season's skis. So we have all the brands here and we've got all of next year's skis to lap around on in amazing conditions in La Clusa.
Oh, and what have the conditions been? Monday was wet.
It was very wet. I'll give you that.
Tuesday,
everything got a whole lot better. We had snow all night long, and in the morning it was just deep powder all over the mountain and everyone was having the best time.
And the thing that threw me, because the forecast didn't say it, so yesterday was good, today was supposed to be a dusting, and today was deeper.
It was deep. It was a little bit wind affected, so it was a little bit more packed down, but that gave us another challenge to go through with the skis, so it was all good.
Yeah, great opportunity to revisit some stuff for some deep conditions. So then we've got some firmer stuff later in the week. So from what we've skied so far, any highlights?
Oh, tough choice. There's been so many great skis and I've had so many amazing runs from all this great snow, but I think the Vocal Mantra 102 Women's was a real highlight. And also the Casely Paragon 101 was just so smooth on all the snow.
Volcal smashing. So they've got a V-Wix 100 ski and it's £1,750. So £1,750 without a binding. So it's expensive, but it is incredible. And there's only a limited few of them. So I'm so glad that I got to ski that. But Salomon smashed it with their QST 100s. And Faction is a freeride company, has a skinny 79p ski, which blew me away. So it's been really exciting to get on stuff for next year. So anything you're looking forward to over the next couple of days? What skis?
Well, I'm getting on Piste, actually. So nice. I'm looking forward to having a few rips around on the nice,
stuff.
Smooth Piste. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the next 2 days stuff should be mega. So yeah, Ian, I look forward to chatting to you about these ahead of next winter. But yeah. Oh, hopefully that gets you excited. Bit of powder does you the world of good.
Woo! So I highly recommend you check our previous episodes on the Skipedia YouTube channel and our old podcast if you want to find out about the best kit for this year. If you want to find out about the best kit for next year, make sure you join us in the autumn. Now, Nancy, we're going to move on to you and Big Sky. You mentioned you're on the mountain every day. That is because I think you're the resort's ski patrol director and you've been working ski patrol there for quite a long time, 20 plus years.
Yep, that's right. I started my story in Big Sky 24 years ago, taking a break from college and came to Big Sky to visit a friend. And the rest, as they say, is history. But after a few seasons working at night as a server and a bartender, I earned a position on the patrol and have been lucky to make a career out of it. So I'm now in my second season as the ski patrol director here.
And how many people working in your team?
Our team is a total of 163 patrollers. That includes 126 paid patrollers and 37 volunteers.
Wow. That is a big team. Now, this could be a podcast in itself, but can you give us an insight into what the ski patrol does? I mean, people conceptually, oh, yeah, I see those guys out on the mountain and maybe I hear a bit of blasting. But, you know, what is the role of the ski patrol?
Well, we're the first ones coming up the mountain in the morning and the last ones off at the end of the day. And in between all of that, we're checking the terrain. We're doing avalanche mitigation work. We do a lot of boundary and rope line maintenance, trail markings. Of course, during the day, we're available for guest service and rescue.
I think of all the things you mentioned there, it's the avalanche control that is always the most interesting. You know, I watched a video that you have on your YouTube channel, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, showing, I think it's the gullies or couloirs going off the top of the tram, where... Mm-hmm. and we're going to come on to this, but, you know, those are skiable, but it's a ski patrol have to make sure that they're safe every day. And that involves regularly chucking lumps of dynamite over the side, right?
That's right. Yeah, the avalanche mitigation work is probably everyone's favorite part of the job here. It's exciting and dynamic, and we get to be out there in all kinds of different weather, very cold, very windy, beautiful sunrises.
Yeah, I bet the sunrises are incredible from the top there. Another video that I saw, or it may have been the same one, it showed that it seems that you have quite a strong team, a big team of women within the ski patrol. Is that unusual for a US ski resort?
You know, I don't know how unusual it is for there to be the ratio of women on the patrol at different places. But, you know, we have been really intentional here about having a culture that is supportive, and the camaraderie, that the bonds that just form from doing the type of work that we do and just sharing this passion for skiing, I think has helped made us a strong team.
Well, let's focus on Big Sky Resort itself. I can't remember where I read this quote. It possibly might have been on Stuart's blog, now that I think about it. He said, Big Sky is titanic, sprawling, impossible. To me, it's definitely a bucket list resort, and I'm hoping to do a road trip there at some point. But let's start with some basics. You know, whereabouts is Big Sky? If we're looking at a map of the states, people hopefully would know where Montana is, but they might not.
Well, we're in the southwest Montana, in the Madison Range is our home mountain range. And we're about an hour's drive south of Bozeman, Montana. So Bozeman is our nearest airport. And then we're about an hour north of the west entrance to Yellowstone National Park.
Well, I went to Yellowstone a few years ago in the summer, but you are pretty close to Yellowstone there as well. In fact, I think I read somewhere that you can do like excursions into Yellowstone in the winter on snowmobiles and things like that. Are you that close?
Yep, that's correct. And so for anybody making a trip out to Big Sky, a great opportunity is to also include a visit to Yellowstone National Park in the winter. It's a pretty special experience. It's quite different from the summer and much less people.
Yeah, it was pretty busy when we're there in the summer. And you mentioned you can fly into Bozeman. There's flights from a lot of the major cities in the States into Bozeman.
That's correct. Yep. I believe, I'm not the expert on this, but I believe there are direct flights into Bozeman from a lot of the major U.S. cities, and then a lot of connections through those major U.S. cities.
Well, I was only reading this morning in an article by the British journalist Peter Hardy, who said that if you're flying into Bozeman, you should look out of the window as you're flying in, because you might see elk or moose scattering below. Is that true? Could that happen?
You know, I've never had that experience, but, you know, you're so high up, and when you're coming into the mountains, I've never experienced that, but possible.
Okay, well, let's talk about the resort itself then. But, you know, if you're staying, whereabouts are you staying? What kind of altitude is that?
Well, our mountain village, where our most of our lodging is at about 7,500 feet.
Yep, about 2,300 meters or something like that. And you've got access to a very large ski area, 5,850 acres of skiable terrain and 38 lifts. I mean, that's pretty big by US standards. In fact, I saw it described as the biggest skiing in America as a kind of strap line.
We're the third largest ski resort in the US and the largest in Montana.
Right. Okay. So, but it's overall twice the size of Breckenridge, Jackson Hole, Copper Mountain, Sun Valley, Beaver Creek, other resorts that I looked up. It's a big ski area, and you get a lot of snowfall as well. I think this is the key. 400 inches. Translating that, 400 inches comes across around 10 meters of annual snowfall. Let's come to Lone Peak then. That's like the home, the symbol of Big Sky Resort. I saw a quote where it said, "It's striking no matter where you approach it from, a statuesque mountain framed by smaller peaks with intimidating summit chutes that gently roll over into acre upon acre of crisp groomers and well-spaced trees." So Lone Peak has symbolized the best of Montana's skiing. And we mentioned the tram earlier. the Lone Peak Tram cable car to us in Europe, I think. When did that open?
Well, the original Lone Peak Tram opened in 1995. And then our new tram was opened last season.
Okay, and I had Peter Landsman from Lift Blog on the podcast in episode 181. He described it as one of the lifts in the States that you must ride. Would you rate it that high? One of your favorites? I guess you're going in it most days.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, skiing from the top of Lone Mountain is, I think, the reason that I was drawn to stay in Big Sky and work on this mountain. For anyone, going to the summit of Lone Mountain for a scenic ride or a view is a great experience. We now, with our new tram, we have increased capacity for being able to offer that scenic experience if you're not ready to ski off the tram.
Yeah, I mean, the new lift has a capacity of 75 people. I also read maybe on Peter's blog, it travels at 10 meters per second, which is very fast for any lift. When I was looking at the piece map, Nancy, or the trail map, as you might have it over there, it looked very interesting. All of those different runs coming down off the top of a Lone Peak. Yeah, in Europe, typically things are green, blue, red, black. In the States, you get black diamonds, double black diamonds, and triple black diamonds as well. And there are a few of those on the trail map there off Lone Peak, right?
That's right.
So what's it? How does access to that work? Because coming from Europe, am I right in saying that, you know, there's a kind of quota or control on how many people can go down those runs?
We don't have a quota on any of those trails. We do have some managed access areas. We have the Big Couloir and the North Summit Snowfield, where we limit the number of people going down those, and that's a safety measure that we do.
Oh, and at the top of that, then, are there sign-in sheets? Is that how that works? You know, people kind of note that they're going into it, maybe you have to queue, and then you go down and you get access.
Correct. So we have a station at the summit where guests can come in to check in with patrol. And usually we have a conversation about what the conditions are like, what trails are open in those areas. And then we have an additional sign out sheet with time slots so that people are assigned to a certain time to go in those areas.
Sounds really interesting. Another thing I read, you obviously opened that new lift, the Lone Peak Tram, a few years ago. That was celebrating the resort's 50th anniversary. There's also a new Explorer gondola. I think that's maybe planned to open for next season.
Correct. So the new Explorer gondola is going to replace the last original chairlift from the resort from 1973. And so that's going to connect our Mountain Village base area to the bottom of the tram base. And we'll have a mid-station unload along the way.
Oh, and so to summarize then, I mean, Big Sky, it sounds fantastic being surrounded by nature. You've got the incredible Lone Peak area. You've got a big ski area, lots of lifts and lots of trails. Who would you say Big Sky is for? What type of skier?
I would say Big Sky is for anybody that wants to be out skiing and enjoying the mountains. We have a great variety of terrain. We have plenty of slopes for beginners, everything in between, all the way up to those triple black diamonds that you mentioned with our hike to terrain, steep couloirs and chutes, open, wide open bowls, and lots of great tree skiing.
Well, it sounds great. I'm definitely very keen. I've mentioned this before, a kind of road trip. I kind of have planned where I'd like to kind of fly into Salt Lake and drive around a bit of Utah and Jackson, Big Sky and Sun Valley. I have a friend of mine from university lives in Sun Valley, maybe finish that trip there. So maybe one day, Nancy, we'll cross paths on the slopes there itself. That's really helpful. Thank you very much. I'm going to move on to Stuart now, if I may. Stuart, I noticed on your blog, on your website, it says that your task really is, it says, everyone's searching for skiing soul. I'm trying to find its brains. I love that idea. You're doing an investigation into snow sports in the States, you know, into what drives it. And you have so much knowledge of the industry. You know, I thought my show notes were detailed until I started to read yours for your different podcasts. You've spoken to so many people in the North American ski industry. I wondered if you could just tell me a little bit about your background first. What led you to start the Storm Skiing blog and podcast?
You know, 99% of skiers spend 99% of their time skiing off a lift at a ski area. But the ski media in its transition to digital over the past 2 to 3 decades, really got away from covering the resort experience in favor of what I classify as stoke journalism. It's the guys jumping off cliffs and skiing out of helicopters and backpacking into Alaska and doing all these wild things that are cool and interesting and fun to watch in doses, but it's not really relatable and it's not, frankly, super useful. Sometimes I just want to read about Killington, or I want to read about the new lift at Vail Mountain, or I want to read about how to ski between Alta and Snowbird. And these things had fallen out of mainstream coverage in favor of more of these adventure type stories. And what filled the void, unfortunately, is what's filled the void in everything, which is social media. And there's a lot of enthusiasm on social media, and there's a lot of ski enthusiast groups bunched around any topic you can think of: Northeast skiing, epic passes, Colorado skiing. Not always the best information that they're working with. It's a lot of hearsay. It's a lot of opinion. It's a lot of anger sometimes. So what I wanted to do was bring a journalistic point of view into this, into the lift-served ski world, or back into it rather, because in the 1990s, the magazine coverage was excellent. You had very well-written, well-edited magazines, and those have mostly faded.
I find that a really interesting observation, what you say there, because there were previously many more magazines and journalistic pieces. What I often see in magazines now is they're just like advertorials or kind of features or promotions for a resort. Yeah. So evidently there's a demand for, you know, good journalism that hasn't gone away. And as you observe, most people are not hucking off cliffs or climbing into the backcountry. While it's fascinating to hear about it, the vast majority of skiers are on groom runs going off lifts. So were you working in the industry prior to setting up Storm Skiing?
No, I've never worked in skiing. I was trained as a journalist. I ended up in the corporate world doing a lot of corporate writing. Always had that bug and started this as a Substack newsletter in 2019. It is now my job. Now my full-time job. I was able to monetize it.
For listeners, have a look, and there'll be links in the show notes. You'll see that Stuart has spoken to the owners or the managers of so many of the different ski resorts and ski areas across the states. And I think I read that you said you'll never run out of ski areas to cover. It's a bit like, you know, me in the ski podcast. If you have a passion for it, you know, there's so many ideas, there's so many things to talk about. But the reason I wanted to have you on the show today was I wanted to lean into your knowledge of multi-passes for the benefit of our listeners. Because, you know, back in 2008, I think it was, something called the Epic Pass arrived, and it just changed everything, really, as far as skiing is concerned. Now we've got Epic, Icon, Mountain Collective, the Indie Pass. So let's look at numbers to start off with. If you're talking about the states, do you know what proportion of people have at least one multipass these days?
We don't have numbers on that. What we do have numbers on is the number of skiers who ski on a season pass product, which includes the multi-mountain passes, the mass market passes like Epic and Icon. It also includes your local season passes at places like Mount Peter, where I take my son skiing. So that number, interestingly, has risen considerably since the introduction of the Epic Pass and the Icon Pass, because it has mainstreamed the idea of a season pass and changed it from a product for a niche product for locals to a mass market product for everyone. And there's been some other incentivizations around the price structure that make people more likely to buy season passes, including the rising price of day passes.
For sure. Well, that's the next question, which you're kind of anticipating a little bit there. I mean, part of that motivation for buying season passes is that walk-up rates are so high. I think it was in one of your other blogs somewhere, they're so high they'd embarrass Prada.
Yeah.
You know, there are huge benefits to resorts from selling the season passes. But, you know, I'm writing a blog post at the moment for a client who's based in Zermatt, and a lot of their clientele is American. I was looking at the prices, and I worked out in US dollars, and I think it's like $93 US dollars a day for a lift ticket in Zermatt, and it's $250 in equivalent larger resorts in the States. But do people still buy day passes, walk-up rates, when their prices are like that?
It's a mistake you only make once, but yes, they do. And I will tell your listeners, anyone coming from Europe, do not go to the United States without a multi-mountain pass. If you intend to ski any of the resorts that you've heard of, if you walk up to the ticket window at Vail Mountain or Beaver Creek, it might cost you $329 to ski for the day. And most big mountains, there are some exceptions, but most big mountains in the Western United States and increasingly in the East in New England do follow this model where at most major mountains, it's $200 plus per day if you walk up to the ticket window.
Yeah, exactly. So there's benefits for the consumers to buy multi-passes, but there's obviously a significant benefit to the resorts as well in terms of improving their cash flow, giving them predictable income. That's why these passes are being pushed, why the resorts have an interest in more people taking them.
Yeah. So what the Epic Pass did is it completely transformed the business model of skiing for a couple of reasons. Number one, they put it on sale in the spring and then they took it off sale right around the start of the ski season, early December, meaning skiers are highly incentivized to purchase it well before the ski season starts, which decoupled skiing from snow, right? The business of skiing from snow, because typically you'd have a big powder day. Everyone would show up. Now you say, oh, I want to save big on my Epic Pass. I'm going to buy this in March when I get the best price because they increase in tiers going toward December. And so that flooded the ski areas with money in the before winter even started. So if you have a bad winter, I don't know, maybe it's even better because you have a shorter season, fewer operating days, lower operating costs, but then of course, less ancillary revenue on the mountain. But it really shored up the model, and most even independent ski areas have gone toward that.
Right. And so you mentioned like previously you have a powder day and a lot of people turn up. Now you've got a lot of pass holders. Does it mean that resorts can suffer from overcrowding? You know, have caps been used on skiers to try and limit that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Crowding is a very consistent, persistent, difficult problem to solve here in the United States at any mountain associated with the Epic and the Icon Pass. The Epic Pass and Vail Resorts ostensibly has ticket limits around, ticket sales limits around each day, but they so rarely activate them that it's hard to believe in them as an effective tool. For example, when the strike affected Park City, they did not ever limit ticket sales for any of those days, even though the mountain was at 30% capacity. I know we'll get to that. The Icon Pass has done a better job of limiting access by allowing its partners to implement reservation requirements for the Icon Pass. Now, frankly, the reservations aren't real. If you have an Icon Pass and you go up, they're going to scan you in. Now, you might get a nasty warning email and they might even suspend the use of your pass. But if you show up at Jackson Hole and you forgot to make a reservation, you're still going to be able to get on the lift, which I think they should fix through technology means, but they haven't. So there's your backdoor hack if you get shut out of reservations. Jackson Hole is the model of having used this to the best effect because they were absolutely hammered by the Icon Pass. And so they did a few things. They left the Icon Base Pass and only stayed with the Icon Pass and the Icon Base Plus Pass. And then they required reservations for all Mountain Collective and all Icon Pass holders, allowing them to set a number of skiers from those passes on the mountain each day. And it completely transformed the experience and removed that negative sentiment around the Icon and Mountain Collective passes, mostly from the local community. So it is possible. It's hard. And it takes a lot of organization by management and willpower as well, because you're always going to make somebody angry when you start to limit things.
Yeah, okay, that's very interesting. What about the Indie Pass? We've discussed the Epic and Icon quite a lot. You described the Indie Pass somewhere as a disruptor and the coolest thing going. Yeah. What do you like about the Indie Pass?
So the Indie Pass is more of what I would describe as a frequency pass. So the Indie Pass, it's incredibly affordable, first of all. So the price last spring, if you got in early, was $329, which, yes, is the same that I just said a walk-up lift ticket at Vail Mountain can cost you on a peak day. And you get 2 days each at several hundred resorts, including now some in Europe, a couple bigger ones in Austria, Ski Welt, and I forget the name of the other one off the top of my head. And there's a big one in Spain, Baccaria Biscay. So it's growing. I believe, honestly, they will have hundreds of resorts in Europe within a few years because there's just so many ski areas over there. But the Indy Pass is fantastic because it's created these nodes of regional density around the Midwest and around New England and around the Rockies and in parts of Canada where you can form a perfectly good week-long or two-week-long or month-long ski safari hitting a succession of resorts that are, in many cases, not that far apart from each other. And this includes some very, very good ski areas. And they're not places that you normally would hear of internationally, but I'm telling you, they will give you a great ski day. And I'm talking about places like Tamarack and Brundage in Idaho, which are only about an hour apart. You get 2 days on each on the Indy Pass. They both have vertical drops and skiable acreage comparable to what you would find at many of the Colorado resorts. They get about 300 inches of annual snowfall, and there's just no one there. So you're not waiting in these long lift lines. Now, you're going to have to ride some fixed grip lifts. They also have high speeds. But, you know, I went to Silver Mountain a couple of weeks ago up in Idaho, and it's all fixed grip lifts, but it's over 2,000 vertical feet. You know, you can convert that to meters. It's 1,600 acres, which is big, and it's wide open, and there's the snowfall is great, and there's just no one there. The Indy Pass is filled with ski areas like this, and I personally think that while your resort experience will not be as gold-plated as what you might find on an Epic or Icon Pass resort, I think your ski experience will be as good and in many cases better on an Indy Pass if you hit some of the better regions than on these other passes, just because you're not going to have to fight crowds and traffic and expenses on every little thing.
That is really interesting. I think, you know, a lot of listeners to the Ski Podcast, based on my communications with them and feedback I've had, will be really interested to hear that. We have a pass called the Magic Pass in Europe, which predominantly is smaller resorts rather than larger resorts, predominantly in Switzerland. But you can get some amazing value for money out of it. It applies summer and winter as well. And we've certainly had some listeners who've gone out and enjoyed that. And with the Indy Pass as well, it has happened. You know, they're quite good at their marketing. They've got Glencoe in Scotland on there, and the Snow Centre, which is an indoor snow centre in England as well. I haven't heard any American voices there yet, but maybe there will be. What about down the track? Because we've got Epic Icon with Mountain Collective that we haven't really covered as well. Do you think there'll be, you know, mergers between these passes, or like a single collective super pass will emerge down the track?
No. For the moment, antitrust laws are still sufficient in the United States to prevent that. You won't see one mega pass. That's sort of what Vail had going, and then Icon stepped in to compete, and they openly, publicly embrace each other, I think, because they want to avoid the appearance of wanting that monopoly. And there's just too many ski areas and too many egos in the ski industry to allow that to happen. Now, the overlap, the point I'll make here is that the Icon Pass and the Mountain Collective Pass have very similar lineups. And for a lot of international visitors, the Mountain Collective is going to make a lot more sense because it is about half the price of the Icon Pass. And unlike the Icon Base Pass, it has no blackouts. And unlike the Icon Base Pass, you can access Jackson Hole, Alta, Big Sky, Snow Basin, and Sun Valley. And those are all on the Icon, full Icon, but not an Icon Base, but they are on Mountain Collective. No blackouts, only 2 days at each, but it's probably enough if you're skipping around.
Yeah, it does sound an excellent value. Well, that's really interesting. And, you know, it will be interesting to see how multi-passes progress. So I think I read that Epic Pass sales were down for the first time since it launched in 24-25. And Vail Resort stock price is down. And as we have a ski patroller on the podcast today, it would be remiss of me if I didn't, you know, bring up the recent ski patrol strike that they had over in Park City. I think it created some terrible PR for Vail Resorts. Stuart, do you think that's going to affect future sales of the Epic Pass?
Absolutely. The fallout from this will be quite long lasting. It just so happens that the very people who can afford to take a week-long ski vacation in Park City over the Christmas holidays are the same people who tend to work as things like stock analysts. So the amount of media attention that this got and the way that that rolled into things like activist investors now calling for the removal of the CEO is creating a sense of unrest and chaos within Vail Resorts that I think is inevitably going to continue what's been sort of a lack of focus on the main product, which is the Epic Pass over the last few years. From my point of view, I think it's a bit of a stagnant product in North America. I think they're a little too over-focused on growth into Europe, where I'm not convinced that this model will work. They're not really taking care of their small feeder resorts in places like the Midwest and Pennsylvania, where a lot of operational issues consistently come up with lifts and runs not being open and insufficient snowmaking. And I think that's why you led to, I think that's a lot of those factors are what led even before the strike to, as you'd referenced, the drop in Epic Pass sales for the first time ever for 24-25. And I think that this strike certainly did not help and will not help.
Yeah, well, it's going to be very interesting to follow that and also Vail Resorts expansion into Europe, something we've covered on the podcast many times before. And listener, if you're not familiar with that, I'll put a link into the show notes for interviews that we've done previously in relation to Crans-Montana and Andermatt, which are the two resorts that they own in Europe. And we've had rumors of various others that they'd be interested in buying. Well, we're just going to move to the close now. But before we do, Nancy, I wanted to ask you a question. Are you a fan of Uncle Dan's cookies?
Yes, I love Uncle Dan's cookies.
I'll tell you why I'm asking, because Stuart, when he went over to Big Sky for the opening of the Lone Peak Tram, decided that Uncle Dan's cookies is one of his favorite bits of the air. Is that right, Stuart?
Yeah, and I'm curious what happened to that little shack when they put in the new lift this year, Nancy. Did they move it? For Madison 8?
No, it's still there. So okay. You can still swing by and grab a couple cookies on your way back up the mountain down there.
Incredible.
Excellent. That's good to hear. Okay, we're going to move to the close now. Feedback. I like all feedback about the show. I'm really interested to hear what you think, listeners. So please do contact me on social, at the Ski Podcast, or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. Also on Blue Sky now, you can find us there. Charlie Owen said, I enjoyed episode 232, your interview with Mark Smith. He is a man in seat 61, train travel expert. Charlie Henry Mack also thought it was a great episode. And Marcus sent me an email to say, I just want to drop you notes. I've started listening to podcasts on my drive into work. And it's great. Brilliant to have such a good UK-based ski podcast. So thank you very much, Marcus, Charlie and Charles. Now, don't forget, I'm still on the lookout for ski Valentines. Did you meet your partner on a ski holiday or during a ski season? And do you fancy sharing your story? Drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com if you don't. Now, there are now 247 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. 192 of those were listened to in the last week. If you enjoyed this episode, why not go to theskipodcast.com, take a look around the tags and categories. There is so much in there. We definitely haven't covered everything in those 247 episodes, but you're bound to find something of interest to you. And in the last week, 60% of our listeners are in the UK, 15% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Hungary, El Salvador, and Lebanon. And finally, if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. Follow us or subscribe. Look for that button and press it now. Give us a review or a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And book your ski hire with InSport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or taking the link in the show notes. Now, you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at The Ski Podcast. We also have a WhatsApp group. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, which you can get information before it's shared anywhere else on social media and behind the scenes. I'd like to thank my guest today, Nancy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian.
And Stuart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.